So my name is Isaac Te Awa. I am the curator Mātauranga Māori at Te Papa Tongarewa, and I descend from Kaitahu, Kati Mamoi in Waitaha in the South Island, and Ngāpuhi Whangaroa on my father's side of the far north. I come across the term takatāpui probably in the late 90s, and at the time, it wasn't a common term, but it was a term that was being reclaimed by Māori. And specifically, the term takatāpui, I heard about it, was associated to the story of Hinemoa and Te Tānakai in Rotorua. And I remember hearing the story, and Te Tānakai, after he married Hinemoa, lamented his hoa takatāpui, Tiki, and it was talking about his intimate companion of the same gender.
When you say it was being reclaimed in the 1990s, who was spearheading that?
So from what I understand, it was pioneers like Elizabeth Kirikiri, who sort of, even earlier than the 90s, was in the 80s that they really sort of rediscovered that term. And takatāpui, in its vanilla understanding, if you were to Google it, it talks about takatāpui being a companion of the same sex. But in a broader sense now, it's understood to be anyone who doesn't identify as heterosexual in the Māori community. So it's a large sort of layer of the Māori community that can identify with that, and it's another complex layer in the rainbow community as well. And so I guess for people who finally heard that story and realized that there was something that had been lost from our culture that they actually fit into, that was normalized pre-colonial, it was something that they could really relate to and identify. So it would be people, Māori, who didn't identify with the normal gender or minority norms that were common at the time.
What does takatāpui mean to you?
So takatāpui to me, I take it, for me I really take it as anyone who doesn't identify as heterosexual. So it is that huge complex community and layers of people who really don't fit into the norm, or the norm as I guess straight society would define it. So takatāpui is anything. So if you identify as anything that is not straight, you are takatāpui if you're Māori, and welcome.
We're sitting within the National Museum Te Papa today, and I'm wondering, does Te Papa have takatāpui taonga in the Mātauranga Māori collection?
I think really to understand that is you kind of have to have an understanding of the collection as a whole. So recognizing that there's 27,000 taonga in the Māori collection, so there's 100 lifetimes and 100 years of research in there. And when we're looking at the tūturu taonga, or the taonga that are collected pre-contact, they were collected without the narratives or association that made them special to people. So while I think undoubtedly there is takatāpui taonga in our collection, is identifying them can be more complex than that. And it's recognizing that collecting was done primarily in the 1800s, usually by white European males who identified as straight, and they were interested in things that fit popular narratives at the time. So there was the dusky Māori maidens in their drapey feather cloaks. It was the noble savage warrior with his weapons. So we have great representation of those things, but we don't have great representation of anything to do with children and the toys they played with, maternal health, childbirth, the recent revival of wahakura, the baskets babies sleep in. We don't actually have one from pre-contact in the collection. It was something that wasn't considered important. And now when we look at the history of takatāpui, which we know was actively suppressed by missionaries, even if there is taonga in there that are associated with takatāpui, they're not going to have those narratives attached to them. What I can tell you is that those taonga do exist in other places. There is a wakahuia, which is a treasure chest, or kind of looks like a little jewellery box. There's one in the Auckland Museum that depicts several females engaging in different sex acts, and it's inlaid with pounamu, so it's a precious object. So it's something that a lot of attention was paid to. And there's one in the British Museum that has the same depictions of men. And so we know that those taonga are out there, And there's probably more stories about those taonga too than there is actual physical evidence. So there are stories of taonga which were sawn in half to take the pretty part and leave the things that were unpopular, like anything that depicts takatāpui. Yeah, so they were actively destroyed, hidden, and discouraged from being collected as well. And that's just part of the suppression that came along with colonisation.
Can you recall the first time you actually set eyes on those two taonga you've just talked about to actually see a physical representation of takatāpui?
Ah, yeah. So I've actually physically seen the one in the Auckland Museum, and it's beautiful. Like, it's stunningly carved. Like, and there is a lot of attention to detail as well. So what we do know is that pre-contact Māori were sex positive. And I say that in the sense that sex wasn't seen as anything as taboo or as a natural part of life. It was just a fact. And that's the attitude that's carried on through Māori art as well. And the one in the British Museum, I've only ever seen photos of it, but again, it's the same. It's a complex piece of art and was really special to someone. And it normalizes narratives that we've already, that we've been taught not to be comfortable with. So they were out there. So Ngā Hina Awe Kōtuku has written about both, and I know she's got quite a few articles and stuff as well. So for anyone who's interested in having a look at them, they're out there.
We briefly mentioned collectors, and I wonder, do you think the collections actually tell us more about the collectors than about the actual taonga?
I think for pre-contact taonga that were collected by collectors, it's kind of a two-edged sword. At one point, we're grateful because we have so much representation that survived in private collections, but it's not true representations of the whole scope of what life was really like pre-contact. So it does speak to collectors and what was popular and what they could trade and what they could sell. But representation as a whole is something that we continually have to work on. And it's just a really important to look and understand that we were more than weapons or stone tools or pretty pieces of painamu, is that there's a complex system of life that existed pre-contact, and not all of that was collected, or the stories about it that are told now are not necessarily truthful or correct. So it's about challenging existing narratives and broadening people's understanding.
Can you tell me who were the main collectors at the time?
So Webster, Kenneth Webster, is someone that we have a huge collection from. We have a huge collection from a man named Oldman, who existed, never actually come to New Zealand, but lived overseas in England. Had a house full of taonga from New Zealand and the Pacific. And there's stories about him in World War II. During the air raids, him and his wife would sit on the roof and pour buckets of water down whenever there were fires. And because he did that, his house was the only one that survived in the neighbourhood. And when he died, his taonga all went up for auction, and they were brought by the New Zealand government and spread between the four main museums. And they're some of the oldest taonga that we have in our collection. A lot of them are collected by Cook as well. So it is those collectors who did keep things safe, and we can learn a lot from them, but also recognising that there are other things out there as well that tell their own story.
And you were saying it also about missionaries. There was a strong missionary influence?
Yeah, so part of the colonisation process in Aotearoa did involve missionaries. So it involved setting up Christian missions and schools. One of the things that happened there is we see a lot of whakaeroa carvings that have removed noses and removed penises or genitalia. We also see a lot less carving of women from that time period after contact with missionaries. So when we look at the removal of the nose or the ihu, the common Māori greeting of the hongi or the sharing of breath, it wasn't really understood by early missionaries, so it was seen as a form of witchcraft. So cutting the nose off was one thing. And they're not nicely cut off. They're actually quite brutally hacked off. And penises were the same. So anything sexually obscene was removed. And for me, when I look at carvings like that, and in our storeroom there is a corner that has three of them, it's about stripping spiritual identity and sexual identity. So it could be rebuilt in the European context. And this was done at an age before the church was important to a lot of Māori, because today it is, but it sort of come at a consequence of things, in this case, spiritual and sexual identity. And there's still consequences that we live with today.
And I could imagine retaining the taonga, but actually defacing it. It is really an assertion of power, isn't it?
Absolutely. So it's these are ancestral representations of people. So these are ancestors that would have been really important to people. The other thing about these three particular that I'm talking about is they're all from different areas around New Zealand. So, and they're all from different time periods. So what that tells us is that this was something that was happening over the whole country. Recently we did a back of house tour with SMA Ranapira, and they come through back of house with the intention to write something that reflected on their own takatāpui identity and experience. And it was these three pieces that Issa chose to write about, seeing similarities of their own identity and the mutilation to the body parts. So they wrote a poem for us, which has recently gone on to Te Papa's LGBTQI plus hub. And it's about reclaiming a lot of those narratives, but also not hiding that they've happened or they still have an effect on people today. And so there, while these taonga have been defaced, they still have stories and experiences and things that they can teach us.
Are you able to tell me a wee bit more about the LGBTI hub that you have on the website?
Yeah, so the LGBTQI plus hub is basically the brainchild of two of our history curators who have collected a lot of rainbow representation over the probably the last 30 years. So what you're seeing is the life experience of two passionate curators who have worked for a really long time that want to share stories. Recognizing that as a colonial institution, representation hasn't been strong here in the past. So it's figuring out those things that we have that we can use to profile our people and tell their stories. One of the consequences of that was that we recognized that there wasn't a lot of takatāpui representation in the taonga Māori. So having Issa come in and working with some people in our community to see how we can increase that representation is something that's been really important to us. And I've got to recognize Steph and Claire for their work on the LGBTQI plus hub and working with Māori communities in general, because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have the representation that we have here of Carmen Urupe or Steph's work with the New Zealand AIDS Foundation. So they haven't excluded representation of Māori or left it up to the Māori curators to collect. And I think as an organisation, it's important to recognise that representation needs to be carried by all levels here. It can't be something that's just put into a pigeonhole and left to one person. Otherwise, it's always going to be biased.
So when you find connections that or relationships that are possibly takatāpui, how do you record those in the collection management systems? How do you note that?
I think there's a few, historically there have been objects that have been collected by takatāpui makers, and I think it's really important to note that while the makers were takatāpui, they weren't necessarily collected because of that. So sometimes it was for aesthetic reasons. But for me, in the catalogue, I think the main thing to note is that them being takatāpui adds to their life experience and their art experience. So it adds their māori or their life force to the taonga. So it enhances it. So recognising that as these objects need to be collected, knowing that them being takatāpui adds to it, not in spite of them being takatāpui, that they can produce something of beauty. It's more complex. It's recognising the holistic whole of a person. The other problem sometimes we run into in the collection is that some of our makers have passed away, so when we identify them as takatāpui makers, sometimes their living descendants and family aren't comfortable with that. So we have to find ways that where the information is there, but it's not necessarily a public view that will hurt a lot of their relatives. So how I would approach it now is by having the conversation and asking and seeing what people are comfortable with representation, seeing what stories they want to be out there, and trying to tell a whole story. And that's easy to do from the start rather than looking backwards and trying to add it in later.
Are you aware of families that do feel that shame, or that they just don't want to recognise the kind of tuckatuckiness?
There are a few examples, and it is sad, but it is also recognising that people know different layers and different experiences of a person, and that's what makes up the whole. So it's a fine line respecting someone's wishes and then having something out in the public just because we can.
This conversation reminds me very much of an event here at Te Papa about a year ago. It was Chris Brickell and Will Hansen talking about what makes a queer object. And is it the maker? Is it the person that uses the object? Is it where the object's placed? Do you have those kind of same discussions in terms of takatāpui taonga?
Oh, absolutely. And it is all of the above. Or sometimes it's takatāpui that take to an object because they feel that it represents them, even though it may not be made by a takatāpui person. Identity is complex, if it's anything. And how we identify a taonga is how it's really up to the community. They choose their taonga and they choose what has significance to them.
I'm also reminded of, didn't you do a tour during Pride with the Matauranga Māori collections?
I did, and in that, if there's anything I want people to take away is that the history of collecting, but also recognising that there's a lot of duality in taonga. So on one of those tours, I was lucky enough to have Yuki Kihara there, and no one actually told me that Yuki was there. And we talked about gender being, well, I identified it as dual. And Yuki's like, no, it's more like a circle. It's like, oh, I like that. And later a friend of mine was like, no, it's more like a spider web. So it's recognizing that while there is this duality of gender in Māori taonga, that it is complex, it is like a spider web. It can land on anywhere in a spectrum. And we do see that in our taonga. The essence of whakapapa is that it is male and female. And it's the layers that make a whole. So we see waka from the above view are feminine. It looks like a vagina. From the side view, they're male. It's long. And we see that in putatara, where the shell component is feminine, represents the female opening, or the whare tangata. The mouthpiece is male, which is long and made of wood. And the stories that come along with that are, for the putatara, for example, the shell trumpet is a daughter of Tangaroa, a sea slug who fell in love with a tree, and a daughter of Tanya, a man. So both elements are represented in the taonga. And we see that right through our taonga, all through our collections. So it's getting people who come in on Pride to recognise that nothing was ever as simple as male and female. Everything was elements that added to a whole. Another thing I like to talk about on those tours is I call it object bouncing. So it's one favourite thing I like to talk about is the ship's nail, which in the day, having a nail and being able to hammer two pieces of wood together was amazing. It saved time. So they're real popular objects. They were used for carving. They were used for fishing hooks. But they were also the most common object that was traded in the sex trade. And because of that, we have our blood-borne illnesses, our syphilis. So even stories like that and the story of disease can be bounced off an object as simple as a ship now. So it's finding, while we may not have strong representation, it's finding stories that people can really identify with, that give a sense of history, how things have changed, what may have been lost, but also reclaiming our identity within those stories as well.
You've mentioned a number of taonga, the wakahuia. Are there other instances you know of taonga that would directly relate to takatāpui in whether it's in role or form or...?
I think physical taonga, the most representation, physical representation that we can look at and recognise as takatāpui is in our carving, and that's because it purely because it lasts the longest. Carvings out of wood and stone are going to be around a lot longer than woven objects. But a lot of our stories in takatāpui are carried. A lot of them are actually carried through missionary accounts, through stories of like Hine Moa and Te Tānakai. Reclaiming those knowledges that have sort of been suppressed or looking into whakapapa and those pudako and those stories that are handed down, that's where we find the most clues. And that's really the area that a lot of researchers have chosen to explore. That said, because of the history of museum collecting and knowing that there is thousands and thousands of objects, a different set of eyes may turn up something different. When you have a collection that has been catalogued by people, primarily European people in the 1940s, even if there is representation of takatāpui, if they seen it, they wouldn't have written that down. So it takes a fresh set of eyes and new people to actually go through those collections and explore them, which is the other reason bringing people in on pride is so important. It's recognising that they may see something different that I don't see, and vice versa.
And we could actually say the same thing about the some of the other collections within Te Papa, in that, I mean, prior to homosexual law reform, you know, in the 80s, whether things would have been catalogued with a kind of a homosexual slant.
Oh, exactly. They're the legacies that we really live with and are obligated to undo as well. As part of our role is to fully explore our collections. They can tell more stories than even we realise. It's looking at everything with those different eyes and sharing with the public as well, who may reinterpret them in a different light.
So how do you go about, say, decolonising the cataloguing of taonga?
It's an endless job. So priority number one for me is, if we acquire anything new, to be really honest and to really be really thorough and complex about how we catalogue and what stories we attach and put in there. But for me, really, it's every record that I go into, I try to leave it in a better state than when I found it. But it's a 100-year project that will keep going. And to be honest, I don't know if that work can ever really stop, because who knows what biases I have now that people may identify in another 100 years. So I think it's just one of those ongoing things that's part of being a curator and working in a museum. And those stories always need to be interrogated and brought forth and looked at again from different lights.
So as a curator, are you consciously or proactively bringing in takatāpui taonga now?
Oh, we are. So since the LGBTQIA plus hub, and recognising that we didn't have strong Māori takatāpui representation, at Te Papa, our collecting is guided by a collection strategy, and takatāpui is something that wasn't on it. So something we've recently reviewed and added, and those taonga reviews or those collection strategy reviews are really crucial to identifying and bringing in those gaps in our collection.
Because if it's not in the strategy, it won't get collected.
It's not that it won't get collected. It's more that having something in the strategy that really identifies an area really gives us the authority and power to go out and have a look for it. It's something, their collection strategy, they guide our collecting. We can bring in other things, but it's identifying it as a primary area is something that's really important.
For you, what are the most significant taonga here at Te Papa?
So for me, so I'm biased. I come from a background of weaving, so I love weaving. So my favourite taonga are what I like to call transitional taonga. So they're the taonga that come from the early period of contact with Europeans. So out of this era, I see taonga. There's a particular cloak that is woven from kiwi feathers, very traditional. But what it also has is little flecks from a peacock tail woven through it. So it kind of has this effect of glitter that rolls through it. So it's a new interpretation of something that was woven pre-contact with a new flair. So it's that recognizing that in Tauranga, the only thing traditional about them is innovation, the drive to use new materials or incorporate things that can tell different stories, that can make something new and unique. There's a similar cloak that is a it's what we call a kaitaka, so it's all about the demonstration of skill. And this one is has wool of every color you can possibly imagine woven through it. And it's what we call Berlin wool. It's the wool that's picked out of hats and blankets. So what you see there is somebody who had a pre-contact color palette of black, white, brown, and yellow, and they just have access to vibrant color for the first time, and they create these new and unique, beautiful objects. And they're the Tauranga that are the special ones for me, because they show that our people have always evolved and moved, but we're creative and patient at the same time.
Just finally, I'm wondering, there are lifetimes of work here at Te Papa and going through the collections. In 100 years' time, how would you like to be seen by the people looking back to your time?
Oh, me. I guess the fundamental thing about working with collections is that it's not about you. So the job of curators is to tell the stories of objects. And historically, that's been done by people writing about things that they have no experience on. So ideally, I would like to be the person that empowers the community to talk about their own stories, rather than the person who sits here in the institution and writes about communities without ever talking to them, which is historically what's been done. So if I can help facilitate that, I'm happy